From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. After 11 full weeks of being told to stay home, the killing of George Floyd caused our city to come outside in great numbers for the first time in months, to walk in solidarity with righteous anger. This week, I was moved to see the grace and compassion from restaurateurs whose restaurants experienced damage. Instead of being angry at the loss, they posted messages of solidarity for Black Lives Matter. Let's say that again. Black lives matter. Property can be replaced. Lives cannot. The only way to talk about food in such times is to acknowledge that food and food media are not free of overt or structural racism. Who am I, an older white woman, to give you comfort this week when I feel like it's about time we owned our own discomfort, sat with it a while, and learned from it? It's my job to speak, but all I want to do right now is listen. And Lewis Hunter has a story to tell. Lewis is the owner of Trio, the first 100% Black-owned vegan restaurant in the state of Minnesota. He's also a cousin of Philando Castile, the man whose death at the hands of a police officer was live-streamed on Facebook by his girlfriend Diamond Reynolds. We first learned Lewis's story from an article that Priya Krishna wrote for Bon Appetit after the killing of George Floyd, and we are so grateful he's taken the time to talk to us. Hi, Lewis.
How you doing?
I'm good. It sounds like today is a good day for you.
Oh, yes. We at the restaurant today. We had reopened up today after the terrible murder of Floyd. Yes, today is the first day we have reopened back up.
You know, all of us who have been watching from all over the country, from all over the world, really, have so much feeling for what's happening in your city. A few years ago, you participated in a demonstration, much like what we're seeing this week in cities all over America. What happened?
Yeah, it was just attending, just like everyone else is doing right now. And got on the freeway, peacefully protesting, got hit by one of their rubber bullets. And the next day, I was getting arrested and facing 20 years in prison for throwing Molotov cocktails at the police, which I fought that case for two and a half years almost. And with the community support and community leaders like Nakima Armstrong and Chantel Allen, Sarah Woodcock, these people and the rest of the community, many more, Unicorn Riot, helped get those charges dismissed so I didn't have to go into prison and do those 20 years with something I'd never done.
I can't even imagine. I cannot imagine what it would be like to live through every day of those 2 years.
Wow.
You must have lost a lot during that period of time.
Oh, yes. I lost my vehicle, too, because when they pulled me over, they took the vehicle from me because they said that was the vehicle I had Molotov cocktail. So they kept that as evidence, which my vehicle was my business. I do landscaping. So they took my business from me at the same time, took my vehicle. And then a week after I got out of jail, I got kicked out of my home. So I lost everything within 2 weeks. Everything I had, I built, was all gone due to me attending a protest peacefully, like I'm supposed to, and I almost lost everything.
It must be really hard for you to watch all the young men out on the street now and know what might be ahead of them.
Man, that was one of my number one things is who was going to be the victim this time. Like I was, okay. Everything said and done. In the background, people that don't know that one man is facing that much time, who is he going to be this time? So personally, I'm trying to put something together to find out any Black man in America. I don't want to just do Minnesota. I want to do in America that's facing some high times. Like I was facing 20 years. I want to be a part of that and with his community or my community and get somebody on that because I got falsely accused 2 years, and they're going to do that to somebody else. And I'm just hoping it don't happen. And I'm willing to step up and take that challenge of helping somebody get those charges dropped, just like people had helped me.
So you mentioned that you had a landscaping business.
Yes.
How did you end up turning to a restaurant to help you put your life back together?
Okay. I was going out with Sarah Woodcock and Dan Woodcock. They was taking me out. We was trying to rebuild my life. You know, I lost everything. So we was trying to every which way to find ways to rebuild my life. And I was taking Sarah some of my business ideas as far as I was going to do with other people. And one of them was I was going to do a food truck with a friend of mine for the Super Bowl when it was here in Minnesota. And it did fall through. And when I was taking those ideas to her, and Sarah knows that it was falling through and it didn't work for me, she was like, what did you think about opening up a vegan restaurant? Now, at this time, we was going to different restaurants tasting vegan food. She was taking me, and I was just experiencing vegan. And I was like, okay, I like it, but it was bland to me. And I always felt that the need that if I did it, I would season it more. And so when she asked me, I'm like, well, if we do it, we got to season the food. She was like, man, amazing. We could do it. So that was just a conversation. 1 month later, we was doing pop-ups out of Kendra Kitchen over North Minneapolis. And our first pop-up, we did a burger. It did pretty good. But our second pop-up, we did a soul food, which is one of my favorite items. We did mac and cheese, collard greens, yams, cornbread, and a protein. But we use ribs. Irvin's Butcher ribs that they had, and it sold out. We had opened from 5 to 9:30, and it sold all the way out. We had not a drip of food left. So we said, okay, let's try this again. So we did it again 2 weeks later, sold all the way out, and we put more food on this time. Sold all the way out. So we really knew we was onto something, and we decided to open up a restaurant.
So tell us where it is. Describe the neighborhood.
Uptown, nice neighborhood. It's predominantly white, you know what I mean? So for me to be up here by myself as a black owner like I am now, I get some challenges, but it's nothing that God can't handle. So peaceful neighborhood, usually nice around here, you know. It's a late night, like, go out scene, you know. It's pretty peaceful. It's nice, a nice neighborhood.
Have you been worried for the business in the last few days?
Well, honestly, I could be honest, no. And why do I say that? Because I really believe in God. The whole thing of Trio, it was from God. So, no, I haven't not been worried. But when the protests and stuff was going on, I was a little worried because I didn't want nobody to bust the windows or burn the place down. But otherwise, like now, no, I feel so good to be here right now serving my community good, healthy food to nurture their bodies at a time they out protesting, at a time they fighting, you know? So it's a beautiful feeling for me right now.
Over the weekend, you handed out 300 free meals at Trio. Who were you feeding?
Mm-hmm. I was feeding the people who was walking past, the people that was cleaning up the neighborhood, anybody came, people were in their cars just riding past, looking at all the scenes of what happened on Lake Street. Anyone that came, they got a free meal. And some people got cake, because I had cake as well. And yes, it was a beautiful thing. It was just nice to serve the community a hot dish for they can nurture their bodies, like I said, as they still fight.
You've been vocal about your restaurant being founded on the same principles as the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you talk about how restaurants can be a platform for social justice?
Oh, most definitely. You know what I mean? If the Black Lives Matter didn't step up and see one of their own about to go to do 20 years in prison, which was me, they gave me this. I couldn't have did this without them. You know what I mean? Like, they followers and all that, it trickled onto me and mine, you know? So a platform for something like this will be amazing for black people because we need this, you know? I could have went any other way, but I chose the path of what was given to me, and this was this, vegan food. And like I said, this is a platform that should be for many and many other black people to strive off of and grow off of, because we need this. You know, this is starting general wealth for myself and my family. You know what I mean? Something that we never had.
Philando also worked with food. Can you tell us a bit about your cousin?
Yeah, he worked with food. He was worked at J.J. Hill, and he was there for several years. He loved cooking and serving the kids. I mean, I think this is in any Black American household that we raised up about serving, because we watched our parents serve us and serve people in the community, or have our barbecues, our neighborhood barbecues, and they served us. So this is only just a trickle of what we've seen when we was little that we do now. So this is all this is, you know. It's a give back, you know. Food is love. Whenever you pass, any food handler has to have some type of passion for loving people, because this is what it's about, you know. And this is what we learned as kids from our parents and our peers, you know what I mean, that they was in the kitchen. I seen men in the kitchen. I seen women in the kitchen. This is just something that we always done through our inheritance of our parents and family. So this is like normal. I love it. Even sometimes when I leave the restaurant, I go home and fix food for my family still. So it's just something we love doing.
Are your children involved in the business with you?
Oh, most definitely. My daughter just got off work. So I got my daughter be coming here. I got my sister. She does my peace cobbler, which is Big Mama's restaurant. She's about to open up. I got my mother being here. My niece, she's here. She's my number one prepper at this moment. Her name is Lachey Hunter. It's all my families. We here. We've been doing this, especially through COVID-19, due to the fact of a couple of my workers done quit due to COVID-19. They was getting that money, so a lot of people didn't want to come back to work. So I just put my family in, and we all been doing this during the whole time of COVID-19, which is a blessing.
I'm so happy that you managed to find time to talk to us, given what's going on. And it's good to hear that you're so busy.
Man, God's amazing.
Thank you so much, Lewis.
Yeah, thank you guys for reaching out. And yeah, it's just a blessing, man, to be in the position that I am with Trio and where my life has changed. So I'm just blessed and I'm thanking.
Lewis Hunter is the owner of Trio Plant-Based in Minneapolis, the first 100% Black-owned vegan restaurant in the state of Minnesota. If you'd like to support Trio, you can donate through the restaurant's GoFundMe. We've got a link at our website. Coming up, wondering how to support the Black food community right now? Kat Hong wondered the same thing, so she compiled a list of nearly 200 Black-owned restaurants in Los Angeles. We'll hear more about it next. Welcome back to Good Food. How do I help? It's the central question many are asking this week. We all have a lot of work to do, but economics are powerful and thread through all political realities. So next time you get takeout or you plan to walk into a dining room, consider choosing food from a Black-owned restaurant and fold them into your growing repertoire of options. Become a regular. Kat Hong is an editorial assistant for the Infatuation website, and on her own time, compiled a growing list of Black-owned food businesses. Hi, Kat.
Hi, Evan.
I am so glad you could be here with us this week.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
And I have to say that seeing that list appear was such a relief. What compelled you to put it together?
I think you touched on it completely in your intro. I mean, it was coming from a place of just like, there's a lot of information out there of like different organizations to donate to, different places you can support, things you can post online. Like, it's almost paralyzing how many different options there are, because you just don't know how best to spend your time and money. And so for me, it was just kind of like the restaurants in LA, they've given me so much and I respect them so much as well. And so I kind of just was like, well, if I don't have a lot of money to donate, I don't know even where to start even looking for places. I can do only like one thing really, is make a spreadsheet. And so, yeah, I did that.
So how did you end up pulling it together?
A a lot of different resources. First, it was kind of just based on my own knowledge. And then from there, it was a few different sources from the internet that I looked up. And then I kind of just sent it out. And then now I feel really just proud and happy that this can really be claimed as a community document throughout LA, because almost all of the submissions now and almost everything on the list is been submitted by people in the community. And so, yeah, it's just a total community effort now, and I'm really happy about that.
Perhaps we should just describe the document. What is on it?
So it's a list of Black-owned businesses in LA. And even LA is kind of a nebulous term. There's places like in Anaheim, Long Beach. If they represented themselves as being in LA, I'm like, I'm not going to gatekeep what that means. And so it has the restaurant name, their takeout or delivery status, which one they are offering at the moment, followed by their contact information, phone number, Instagram, website. And then I thought it was also important to include, like, you know, if you don't live in LA or if you don't feel comfortable maybe taking out or getting delivery right now, that's totally valid. And so if you still wanted to support it, put like a link for gift cards, or like if someone had like a GoFundMe or like a merch store, I thought those were really important to include as well.
Is every establishment on the list a brick and mortar?
No, they're not all brick and mortars. Some of them are pop-ups, either from like they have a truck or they have a business where they deliver the products.
Because there are quite a few on there that are caterers. There have always been so many Black catering businesses mm-hmm. in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true as well. What is a restaurant in 2020? I don't know if I'm the one to necessarily define that and to tell people that that's not a restaurant or what is a restaurant. And yeah, to deny the rich history of catering in LA and sharing food that way, it would be insane of me to make that call. So I thought it was obvious that I would include them.
I went to go on Twitter to follow you, and I saw that someone spontaneously bought a domain for the list.
That was incredible. Oh my God. There has been so much spinoffs of this also that I'm like, the ingenuity and the ingenuity of the people following this document have been incredible. Yes, someone bought a domain name. The website is dine.black, no.com or anything, just dine.black. And what this person has done is taken the information, the spreadsheets that exist for other cities, and has compiled them all into one website, which is just, it's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you get to the homepage of dine.black, and there's just all these different cities listed, and then you can go to Los Angeles and click on it, and your list comes up. Is this list open for people to add to, or do you kind of gatekeep so that you can confirm?
I do gatekeep a little bit just to confirm with the businesses and like make sure all the information is correct. I think it would get a bit unruly if I let it open for editing. But anyone can email me at kny@gmail.com or on my Twitter and Instagram. It's all on the top of the doc. And yeah, I mean, it is my personal email. I didn't realize it was going to become like this, but I'm checking it daily. So if anyone has any additions, I'm happy to put them on.
And this is something that you're doing totally on your own. This isn't part of your job with the infatuation.
No. It was just kind of like Friday night when we were closing up shop at work. I was just kind of like, well, it's not enough. I'm like looking online. I was feeling just so like, it's important for these images to be shared and for things to be shared online and for there to be visibility and for people to be saying explicitly that they are pro Black Lives Matter and everything. But for me, it was like, I wish it didn't feel so performative sometimes. And so on my own, I was just kind of like, well, let's just, this is my one skill. So let's do it.
Well, you put your skill to very good use. what restaurants have you already ordered from that you've eaten from?
Yeah, so Bloom and Plume, which is in my neighborhood, is so incredible. They have amazing coffee, incredible merch. But what I also love is that it's owned by this person who is a florist as well. And so they're selling these like little bouquets of really, really gorgeous flowers and everything. And so it's over these last couple of months, I haven't had fresh flowers like in my home or anything. So that was really a beautiful gift to get those from them, or buy them rather. And then for lunch today, I went to Stevie's Creole Cafe for the first time on Pico, and like, it's incredible. I don't know what else to say. I can't believe it's taking me so long to come here.
Tell us what you ate.
Okay, this is all for one person, so please don't judge me. It was fried pickles, and then on top of that, there was like a shrimp mac and cheese, which I really wanted to try, which was great. And then it's this like platter of both fried chicken and some oysters, catfish, and then I got it with a side of greens and grits. And I've been wanting to try this restaurant for a really long time, so I was glad to finally be able to pick it up.
We would never judge your choices.
Okay, thank you. I was like, I don't know if I want to say all of this right now. I'm feeling a lot about myself.
No, I feel like every time I order for takeout, it's for two or three meals.
I'm like, this is meal prepping, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then it also becomes mise en place for something homemade.
100%. I'm like, I think I cooked this mac and cheese because I put breadcrumbs on it.
So great. Thank you, Kat.
Of course. Thank you so much, Evan. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
That was Kat Hong. She created a list of Black-owned restaurants. We have a link to her document on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Kim Prince opened Hotville in the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall in December, after 2 years of hosting pop-ups. 2020 was going to be her year, and then along came coronavirus. Kim comes from hot chicken royalty, growing up working at Prince's Hot Chicken in Nashville, where her family's responsible for creating the dish. Hi, Kim.
Hi there.
I just want to thank you for finding time to talk to us in a week that has been difficult for everybody.
Yes, thanks, Evan. I appreciate you thinking about me to even want to have time to sit down and talk.
So it's been a difficult few months even before this week began. How are you?
We're cooking with grease. I can say that. We haven't stopped. March came and coronavirus showed her head, and we are picking at it like a tick, trying to get things back rolling again. It's been a very, very hard last 3 months, in spite of what's even going on now nationwide and all the upheaval and people wanting to protest and raise their voices as they rightfully should. We are cooking with grease.
I can hear your crew in the back getting some work done. Are you open this week?
We are open this week. I'm open every day except Mondays. Mondays is our day to like deep clean the kitchen and the restaurant and get ready for the rest of the week. So I've always been closed on Mondays. And ever since coronavirus, I was, even though I was scared and my bank account that was verified, the fact that I should have been scared because I wasn't sure if I should have opened up the following week and the next week. And we were literally living like, you know, some people use the phrase living paycheck to paycheck. Well, Hotville was literally living sales day to sales day. I wasn't sure. And I had my crew ready to get that text message on that phone call that we're going to be closing down for a spell. But with tears on my pillow and a whole lot of prayers on my knees, I was determined to stay open.
So the people that have been coming through the store, are they the regulars you've always had? I assume they are, but are you also seeing some new customers that want to be supportive?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I am the past couple, well, you know, because we're a new business and, you know, I live in this part of town, Baldwin Hills, Crenshaw area. I live here. I work here. I play here. Our regulars, we know them by name and face. We know their order before they come in through the door. We know their car. However, we've had a lot of fresh faces, even today, just so many fresh faces. You know, they're coming in saying, hey, I read about you in the LA Times. I want to support the emails and the Facebook messages and Instagram messages, people calling and wanting to donate. And while we don't accept donations, people are buying meals for us to give to first responders, the law officers and firemen that come through. We're able to discount their meals at 100% because there's some wonderful, kind-hearted person out there who I may never, ever meet who wants to go ahead and prepay for that person's meal. So that's one of the approaches that I've been doing to, you know, just keep it 100 with the community out there as we, you know, work through this together. You know, we implemented this senior meal program with the city. The senior meal program was started by my council member in Los Angeles Council District Number 8. His name is Marquise Harris Dawson. And this young brother, African-American male, married, and he is a sound leader for the community that I live in. I live and my business is in his district. I go to church in his district, and that makes it all more special because it's all right here. We're in our 11th week now, serving senior meals 3 days a week. And honestly, I have to tell you, Evan, I prayed right after we closed the, you know, after dining rooms were closed down, because it was such a slow trickle of foot traffic coming into the restaurant. Our delivery platform hadn't launched just yet, and we were starting to take phone orders, and it was still just oh so slow, and I didn't know how we were going to make payroll, and we were going through our savings so quickly. And I mean, literally within 2 weeks, I'm like, wow, how are we going to make rent? So nevertheless, we got a phone call late on a Sunday night from the council member's office saying, hey, we got this program. Are you up for it? Can you feed seniors in the area, prepare some meals, and deliver them? I said, well, how many? They said, we got 35 people. I was like, okay. And they're all at a senior citizen home, which made it really easy to drop it all off. So I said, okay, I'll sign up for that. And so on March 23rd, we did 3 meals that week, dropping off those 35 meals at a senior citizen's home right down the street from our restaurant.
You weren't serving them the Nashville hot, were you?
Oh, Lord, no. No, I wouldn't dare do that. But we did baked chicken the first day, and then we did fried chicken West Coast plain the second time. And then we did fried fish, which is on our menu on that Friday. And they told me that they loved it. And that was warming to me. So I said, let's do this again. They called us. And there's a community group called a Community Coalition that partnered with the council member's office to pay for restaurants, small businesses in the area to support the senior meal program. I just happened to be one of a handful, maybe less than a dozen restaurants that first week. It grew into 30, 40 restaurants that are in the area, caterers in the area that started supporting that senior meal program, which I watched my number increase each week. I mean, there were some times when we were creating 150 meals just in one day to get those delivered by lunchtime. And we had to open up our doors at 11 o'clock as well. So that challenge was one that it was worth trying to overcome. And we did. We cleared that hurdle real well. It's good to know that in week 11, that those seniors are still asking for us. There was kind of a tug of war with some of the senior homes because we were going to the same senior home over and over again for about 2-3 weeks. And then other senior housing complexes started finding out that, you know, they saw pictures of how wonderful our meal was versus some of the other restaurants and what they were doing. And so, yeah. You know, I think I had a little bragging rights there with that. And it's that program. That's the answer to the prayer that I prayed. That senior program definitely kept the business afloat for those first 2 weeks. And then people started coming back through our doors again.
Were you planning on reopening the dining room when you heard that it was going to be allowed?
Yes, I have been strategizing. My business partner and I have been talking about it for well over a month. It was nice to hear that they were planning on reopening. But the cool thing I'll tell you, Evan, is people have been coming in, eating in the parking lot. Because the mall that we're a part of on the same property with, because the mall is shut down, all of our customers just go in the parking lot and they put these cool tablecloths over the hoods of their cars or at the trunk of the car. And they sit out in the parking lot and have a wonderful time eating with each other. And so that's been very amusing and quite of a spectacle to watch. So my game plan for letting people in the dining room, I'm going to take my time on that. I'm not in a rush. You know, they just reopened everything here in L.A. on this past Friday. They made that announcement. And
then the world blew up.
I'm so glad I didn't just, you know, jump the gun too much, because now we've got all this unrest and the tension is really high. And while my community has been relatively quiet and without incident, I'm glad that we're not 100% open yet.
Well, I just want to tell you that I was having a really hard time this morning. I was so down.
Oh, wow.
And talking to you has just changed my mood completely.
Oh, wow.
You are just a treasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, I understand how you feel, because I lay down feeling that way, but and I have to talk myself through it, you know, because, you know, being an African-American woman, being a business owner right here, just steps away from where unrest is happening all around us. It's nothing but God's grace that gives me some relief, that allows me to get up and do this again every day. Because I remember when I didn't have a building and I fried chicken in a parking lot, and I still got the ability to do that. I remember when I was frying chicken in my own kitchen at home, and I had a dozen or so orders, and my friends from church would come over and pick it up. I still got the ability to do that. So I'm going to keep frying chicken as long as I'm breathing. And I know that there's people out there that like Nashville hot chicken, and they will come and find me no matter where I am. And then I look back at my family members, my ancestors started the Nashville Hot Chicken Shack in 1936. Well, guess what was going on then? The Great Depression, Jim Crow, all the segregation. And they were right smack dab in the middle of Nashville starting a brand new business. If they've got the mind to start a brand new business during the middle of the Great Depression, I can do this during COVID-19 and with Black Lives Matter, support Black businesses, administration in the White House that I quite don't relate to. We can do this, but we got to do it together. You feel me?
I feel you, and talking to you has been like the hug that I've needed for the past 11 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Hugging you back, girl.
That was Kim Prince of Hotville in the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall. After we spoke, I ordered 4 of her wings, a side of mac and cheese, and some slaw. It was a delicious food equivalent of a hug from Kim.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
In a minute, we dive into a story of a singular figure, Mahalia Jackson. Hers is a story of activism, economic empowerment, gospel music, and fried chicken. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. For years, I've dreamed of attending the Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium. It's a yearly meeting of the minds of Southern chefs, food writers, activists, and thinkers. It's also an organization that has consistently amplified diverse and complicated stories about food in the American South. Gravy is the excellent podcast out of the SFA, and today as we highlight and celebrate Black entrepreneurship, I want to share the story of Mahalia Jackson, singer, civil rights activist, and the maker of Glory Fried Chicken. This episode, produced by Betsy Shepherd, originally aired on the Gravy Podcast and is the winner of this year's James Beard Award for Best Audio Reporting.
Mahalia holds rank with Elvis and Madonna. As someone so famous, she needs no last name. Crowned the Queen of Gospel, Mahalia took the sound of the Black church to new heights. In 1950, she graced the stage at Carnegie Hall as the venue's first ever gospel singer. She put out 12 gold albums, including Move On Up a Little Higher, which sold over 8 million copies, a record number for the genre. And she packed concert halls across Europe and created international consumer markets for gospel music. But more than anything else she did to elevate gospel, Mahalia Jackson used the sound of the Black church as a reckoning for all the ways American democracy failed to live up to its promises.
Oh,
in 1963, Mahalia Jackson stood in front of the Lincoln Memorial before a quarter of a million people at the March on Washington. Dressed in a brocade suit and a plumed hat, she rallied the crowd with her song, I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned, a traditional African-American spiritual that she turned into a battle cry for equal voting rights and job opportunities. Each note spoke to all she endured as a Black woman from the segregated South, and each note resonated with hope.
This type of work that I do, it is not merely something for entertainment. It is an uplift. It is a reviving for humanity. When man's spirit is low.
That's Mahalia Jackson from a 1966 interview telling why she'd turned down jazz and blues record contracts. Music wasn't just her profession, she explained. It was a spiritual calling. She refused to sing anything but religious songs, and she canceled shows and recording dates if she wasn't able to sing them with full conviction. Though no amount of money could convince her to venture outside of gospel, Mahalia had no qualms about going into the restaurant business. In 1968, the singer launched Mahalia Jackson's Fried Chicken, a franchise that grew to include 135 locations. In much the same way the Kentucky Fried Chicken used Colonel Sanders as its corporate mascot, Mahalia's smiling image was plastered across store signs, menus, and buckets of fried chicken. Why did the voice of the civil rights movement choose to become the face of a fast food chain? Alice Randall, a New York Times bestselling author and Mahalia fan, says the Queen of Gospel's chicken operation was rooted in the song she performed at the March on Washington.
I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned, that's probably the critically important song for understanding the experience of Black domestic workers and Black cooks. Her voice captures the sense that we can get past these things. And some of what we have to get past is a traumatized relationship to food. She wanted to create a positive experience for workers.
Mahalia knew firsthand the indignities of low-paying kitchen work. In New Orleans, where she grew up from 1911 to 1927, there were few jobs for African Americans outside of cleaning and food service.
The only professional person that I know of at the time was school teachers, but most of the Negroes would be maids or cooks. And you would see many children coming down the street with these baskets of iron clothes, taking them back to the white people that live on the better class section of the city. And many of them had to stay out of school to help their family to do this type of work.
Mahalia was one of those children. After her mother died, she was sent at age 5 to live with an aunt who made her earn her keep. She cooked and cleaned for a white family before and after school and dropped out in 8th grade to take a second job as a laundress. Though Mahalia had an especially difficult childhood, few of her peers got an education beyond hers. There wasn't even a high school available to African Americans in New Orleans until 1917. In the Jim Crow South, where African Americans were excluded from most public institutions, the church served as the social, political, and spiritual center of Black community life. Mahalia spent her one day off at Mount Moriah Baptist Church, singing in the choir and socializing at Sunday dinners.
Let the church roll on. Let the church roll on.
It was here that she got the informal training that enabled her to sing her way out of poverty. And it was here that she got the inspiration for the restaurant she would open some four decades later. In white church-like buildings, Mahalia's Chicken served up gospel music and gospel bird.
Fried chicken got the name gospel bird in the early 1920s because what a lot of churches did is they would typically have some kind of fried chicken meal after service.
This is Adrian Miller.
I am the author of the James Beard Award-winning book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time.
According to Miller, chicken's role in African-American spiritualism dates back to pre-colonial West Africa, where the bird was a mark of wealth and was used by some groups as an offering during religious ceremonies. Some of that meaning carried over during the forced migration of West Africans to America, where enslaved cooks developed Sunday meals around poultry.
Chickens were a real important part of the plantation economy because it was one of the few examples where enslaved people were given some autonomy in terms of the food that they were allowed to raise. Chickens were fairly easy to keep, and chickens lay eggs. And depending on how liberal the master was at the time, if they allowed their enslaved people to actually harvest eggs and sell them, it was a way for people to make money. And in some cases, people bought things that improved the material culture of where they were on the plantation. But there's some instances where people actually bought their own freedom.
While those instances were rare, it cemented the bird as a symbol of economic empowerment. Another area in which enslaved people were given a small degree of sovereignty was Sunday worship. While the master usually appointed the preacher and restricted sermons to themes of Christian servitude, congregants developed a coded language and subversive songs to freely communicate with one another and sometimes plan their escape.
Well, it may be the last time we all sing together. Maybe the last time, I don't know. Oh, it may be the last time.
Mahalia's grandfather and her grandparents were born into slavery, and she heard stories about the hardships they endured from her uncle Porter. He cautioned that little had changed in the post-Civil War era, especially in the South, where African-American laborers could barely survive off their earnings and were barred from sitting at the tables that served food made by their own hands. Poverty was like another form of slavery, and it surrounded Mahalia. She saved her money and in 1927, at age 16, bought a train ticket north.
The first impression ever made on me when I got off the train in Chicago was that the Negroes lived in such beautiful, large homes. I saw Negro lawyers where I didn't see Negro lawyers in the South. Mm-hmm. And there were many opportunities for Negroes.
Many transplants couldn't afford apartments with kitchens, so restaurants specializing in Southern food cropped up all over Black urban centers. And so did churches, and sometimes hybrids of the two.
There was one guy named Father Divine, and he really just evangelized and cultivated a following of hundreds of thousands of people through his fried chicken. So he would create these spaces, he called them heavens. And one of the things that he really specialized was what he called glorified chicken.
There is a brighter day ahead.
In the same entrepreneurial spirit as Father Divine, Mahalia started a number of businesses catering to needs she saw in her neighborhood. She launched a makeup line for African-American women and opened a floral shop, which took off when she began offering a funeral package in which she supplied the flowers and the music for the service. It was at one of these funerals that a talent scout from Decca Records heard Mahalia sing and offered her a contract. She recorded and toured the church circuit for over a decade before she landed a hit for Apollo Records with Move On Up a Little Higher, a song that became an anthem for Black upward mobility, which she achieved with earnings from the song. She got her own radio show and television program. She sang at Carnegie Hall and was appointed the official soloist of the National Baptist Convention, where she met Martin Luther King Jr. in 1956. He invited her to join him at various civil rights events, including the Montgomery bus boycott and the March on Washington. Despite becoming a world-famous singer and achieving success beyond anything she could have imagined as a child, Mahalia knew what her life would have been like if singing hadn't provided her ticket out of the kitchens and washrooms where it started. And she carried that pain with her.
I spoke so much about school, one would think that I was highly educated. No, I was very unfortunate not to be educated the way that I had always desired to. As a child, my greatest ambition was to be a school teacher, and I never have reached that goal.
She channeled her childhood dream of becoming a teacher into the Mahalia Jackson Foundation, which provided scholarships to students in need. And later, she opened Mahalia's Chicken, which she envisioned as a business school as much as a restaurant. Riffing off of Father Divine, her signature dish was glorified chicken, a meal that offered a small taste of the Glory Land.
On my way to Canaan land.
After the break, we hear how Mahalia's chicken business took off. That's when Good Food continues after this short break. Welcome back to Good Food. We continue with Betsy Shepherd's story of Mahalia Jackson.
The 1963 March on Washington built political momentum that helped to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which legally put an end to segregation, employment discrimination, and unequal voting registration requirements. After the march, Mahalia continued her activist work with Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, through which she met another important collaborator, Benjamin Hooks, a Tennessee judge who would go on to become the executive director of the NAACP. In 1968, Hooks stepped down from the bench to go into business with Gospel's Greatest. Mahalia's Chicken was conceived as an offshoot of Minnie Pearl's Chicken, the restaurant of a white comedian from Hee Haw, in which Hooks had invested. Here again is Alice Randall.
This is clearly some culinary redlining, that one of them was being targeted towards a white audience and one was being targeted towards a Black audience. And this was with the hope that this would be even more successful, capitalizing on the images these two women had.
Though the twin businesses employed segregated marketing strategies, Mahalia's broke the color line as one of the first Black-owned franchises in the South. And Mahalia's business model radically differed from Minnie Pearl's in several ways, like its labor practices.
She was trying to use as almost a Montessori-like institution to create positive work experiences. There was paid vacation, there was sick leave, there was leadership training. It was the opposite of being buked and scorned. It was employment that came with being respected and cultivated.
Whereas Minnie Pearl's sold fried chicken, Mahalia's menu sold gospel bird.
You see a real celebration of African American identity when you see the Soul Bowl, the Jubilee picnic spread. She's overturning the idea that soul food is a scrap from the table. She's reminding us of old traditions such as church suppers and picnics and fish fries that are actually woven into the African-American experience.
Randall says Mahalia's Chicken was a Trojan horse.
It seems like this is a very traditional, old-timey thing, but it is anything but. It was Black-owned in Black neighborhoods. It's a message that is actually quite radical, this idea of Black economic nationalism. So it was a worthy effort. It was an audacious effort. But in that moment, it was a failed effort.
Mahalia's Chicken went bankrupt in 1972, less than 4 years after the ribbon-cutting ceremony for the first location. The Securities and Exchange Commission investigated one of the financial backers of the company, causing stocks to plummet. Another reason it folded was Mahalia's poor health and sudden death that year. But perhaps the biggest reason Mahalia's Chicken failed to take flight was that her timing was off. She used a business model that was too ahead of its time, and she entered the fast food market much too late. It was hard for a newcomer to compete with Kentucky Fried Chicken's 3,000 locations, which by the late 60s were increasingly popping up in Black neighborhoods.
Mahalia Jackson was providing a recipe for community renewal that failed, partially because of how idealistic her enterprise was. Most failed restaurants are not remembered as preciously as Mahalia Jackson's. It has become mythic in memory.
For many, especially those in the South, Mahalia's Chicken was the Camelot of Black entrepreneurship. It inspired other African Americans to go into business for themselves, including a cook who created a spinoff of a restaurant. That man's name was E.W. Mayo. Here's a 2006 oral history interview he did with the Southern Foodways Alliance.
This restaurant here, this is developed on the good works of Mahalia Jackson. I did not want to see Mahalia Jackson go down, so we have it alive.
Mr. Mayo purchased the naming rights and recipes from Mahalia's Chicken, and then put his own twist and specialties on the menu, including beef tripe, chicken livers, gizzards, chicken hash, and his signature apple and peach fried pies. I wanted to taste his rendition of Mahalia's gospel bird. But the phone number listed for the business was out of service. There wasn't any information online about its closing, so I drove to Nashville to find out what became of Mahalia's last holdout. I drove past Fisk University, a historically Black college, and pulled up to the address listed for Mayo's, where I found a man tending to some barbecue pits next to a small trailer on a concrete lot. A second man taking orders introduced himself as Jerome.
Look, here it is right here. Mayo, Mahalia Jackson, fried pat and chicken. The reason why that's still there, because that's a historical landmark. They won't take that down.
So that's all that's left of it?
Of mayo, fried pies, and chicken, yes.
But y'all are keeping some food here.
Yes, this is Ooh We Barbecue now. They had the 5 best pulled pork sandwich in Nashville. We came in number 3. We have $1 leg quarters.
Okay.
We got shoulder sandwich, got hamburger, rib tip, gizzards, whatever you like.
In honor of Mahalia, I ordered barbecue chicken. Jerome didn't know much about mayos, but he introduced me to someone who might. Next door, at a neighborhood museum, I met Lorenzo Washington.
I'm the founder of Jefferson Street Sound Museum.
Lorenzo told me that Mr. Mayo died in 2010, and a new owner kept the chicken hub going until 2015, when Ooh We Barbecue took over. In the same way that Mayo carried the torch for Mahalia, Lorenzo founded his museum to preserve the memories of Jefferson Street, the center of a once bustling Black business district that was disrupted by the interstate system and ravaged by multiple waves of gentrification.
It was a lively, upscale, upbeat community. There were clubs and flower shops, funeral homes, banks, restaurants all the way down Jefferson Street. You get your good plate of chillings with some cornbread, but you could also come down to Mahalia Jackson and get some fried chicken.
While I toured the museum, I noticed a picture of Mahalia on the wall and asked Lorenzo if she had ever performed on Jefferson Street. He said he'd never seen her, but that her presence was definitely felt there.
Out of Mahalia came greatness. She was a great artist, and she was an activist. So she was a very important person to our world.
According to a 2012 survey by the U.S. Department of Commerce, there are 2.6 million African-American-owned businesses in America, and some 60% of those are owned by women. That's a 1,300% increase over the 200,000 Black-owned businesses that existed at the end of Mahalia's life. Though her own business didn't turn out like she hoped, Mahalia's activism on the stage and at the dinner table helped to expedite some of her prayers.
Let the beauty of the Lord, our God, be upon us, and establish thy work of our hands upon us, yea, the work of our hand.
Lord, when I've done the best I can.
This story, produced by Betsy Shepherd, originally aired on the Gravy Podcast by the Southern Foodways Alliance. Congratulations to Betsy for winning this year's James Beard Award for Best Audio Reporting. That's it for our show this week. If you've missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Kat Yore, Desmond Taylor, and Paul Smith. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. Stay safe, stay engaged. Allow time for self-reflection, and by all means, check out Kat's list of Black-owned restaurants and order yourself something delicious. We at Good Food are here to listen. Send us emails, DMs. We want to hear from you. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.